Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome in, everybody, to the best in true crime podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. Boy, we got an interesting and somewhat grisly True Crime Tuesday today. I read the most interesting book over the weekend, and I'll tell you, it's a little bit of a one that grips you right in the stomach. It's one that if you're of the faint of heart, you probably don't want to read. It does involve the murder of a small child by the name of Lyric, who is 1.5 years old. It is a little bit of a redemption story as well. It is called Immunity for Murder, the Veronica Taft story. And it's written by David M. Beers. David M. Beers holds a Bachelor of Professional Studies degree from Empire State College. Previously, he served 6 years in the United States Marine Corps. Thereafter, he received an honorable discharge at the rank of staff sergeant. Thereafter, Beers became a sworn member of the New York State Police. As a trooper, he excelled in his regular duties and became a police instructor. Later, helping to develop, implement, and teach a statewide highway drug interdiction program. After being promoted to the rank of investigator, Beers received additional training and experience and served in several specialized venues, including narcotics, major crimes, violent felony warrants, and forensics, where he attained experience and proficiency in several forensic disciplines, including evidence collection and preservation, crime scene investigations, fingerprints, arson awareness, fire cause and origin, and bloodstain pattern analysis. Over several years, receiving numerous commendations while routinely maintaining excellent and/or outstanding performance evaluations, Beer's career in law enforcement ended prematurely. And here's what's interesting. We're going to talk to David about this at the beginning of the program. As a result of what later became known as the New York State Police Troop C evidence tampering scandal, Beers, who was initially cleared of any wrongdoing, was later falsely accused of a host of crimes related to his work as a police officer. After a 2-year legal battle, including 2 trials, he was exonerated of all criminal charges. But despite his complete exoneration, Beers was fired from his position as a police officer. Even though his law enforcement career had been ripped away, his training and experience had not. Over the next 2 years, Beers transitioned his training and experience into the private sector and became a licensed private investigator, which is where he comes into the story with Veronica Taft. With his combined experience as a Marine police officer, defendant, and now private investigator, Beers developed a unique perspective of the criminal justice system. Thereafter, starting his own investigation and consulting business, he justly named New Perspective Investigations. That's where he continues to work today. He came across this case with Veronica Taft and her 1.5-year-old son, Lyric, who unfortunately was murdered. And we'll talk about that story here later in the program. Let's welcome to True Crime Tuesday, David M. Beers. David, welcome to True Crime Tuesday. It's a pleasure for me to have you on this program, sir.
Thanks very much for having me. I'm very honored to be on your show and talk about the Veronica Taft story. It was a story that needed to be told. I was directly involved with her case, working on her behalf through her attorney. And it was a kind of a long ordeal. She spent time in prison for a murder she didn't commit. Her other children were taken away from her.
Well, we'll unpack that here in a bit, and we're going to kind of unpack it slowly, bit by bit, because it is a very intriguing story. And unfortunately, I think we all go through periods in our life where we're misconstrued and misunderstood, and definitely Veronica was one of those people, a person with a strong character, a strong will, and someone who really was a survivor. I shouldn't say was, she is a survivor. And we'll get into that here in a little bit later in the program. I want to focus on you first, David, because as I read that bio, speaking of misconstrued and misunderstood, man, you kind of got the, if you don't mind me saying, the shaft on this deal with this New York State Police Troop C evidence tampering scandal. Tell me for a second, or help me outline this for a second. What exactly was this thing?
It's kind of a long story, but one of my colleagues that I had worked with in the identification unit doing forensics work, he had an interest in pursuing his career with the CIA, and so he went there and basically admitted to them that he was willing to do whatever it takes to get the job done, and he went on to admit that he had actually tampered with evidence while he was working for the New York State Police. Well, that kind of backfired on him, and an investigation was launched that led to his indictment, and then kind of spread from there. Went to a second investigator that had worked with him, and he was indicted, and then a third one was indicted. But it didn't stop there. Because in the interim, I had been transferred to the identification unit. I wasn't there when a lot of these previous tampering cases took place, but I had been assigned there, and I worked along side by side these my two colleagues. And again, to make a long story short, one of them kind of pointed his finger at me when he was making a deal with a prosecutor, and they ended up coming after me. But like I said in the bio, they had originally cleared me of any wrongdoing, and then all of a sudden, I find myself being charged falsely with a number of crimes related to my work, and so that's what happened. And I was charged in two different jurisdictions, one in Broome County, New York, one in Tioga County, New York. And so that was a 2-year legal battle, but I got myself a good attorney. I maintained my innocence throughout, and went to the first trial in Broome County, and I was exonerated of everything. Then several months later, I went to trial again in Tioga County, same result. And interestingly, in the second trial, the prosecutor was reprimanded very severely during the trial, right in front of the jury for withholding evidence under what they call the Brady material.
Wow.
Which was a document that he had possession of, which should have been turned over to the defense, and it never was. And the whole thing played out in open court, and he basically got caught red-handed withholding the document. The judge gave him a lot of leeway to try to explain himself, but in the end, he was told that by law he was required to turn over that document, and then he sanctioned the prosecutor right in front of the jury and told them that they could apply the most negative inference to what he had done. So for the most part, the case was over, and I was once again acquitted.
David, I have to ask you this right off the bat. How common is this that a prosecutorial lawyer will try a trick like that? Because it seems to me that I'm hearing this more and more these days that the story will be shaped in a prosecutorial way to try and win a case, especially when it's an elected position. To try and get more and more wins to try and get to that next term.
Yeah, it all boils down to the individual prosecutor. Some of them are, I don't know, I can't explain it, overzealous or trying to make a name for themselves. I don't know. But there's other ones that are excellent that I respect highly. And but you just never know who you're going to be up against. And in the case that against me, the crazy thing was that this prosecutor, he was appointed as a special prosecutor by a judge, and he didn't have any experience. You know, he was he had never prosecuted a case in his life, but yet he's assigned to something as important as prosecuting a public official. And it was a disaster right from the get go. And to me, it was like he was hell bent on putting as many cops in jail as he could. Mm. And but I challenged him and went to court, and basically I sent him home with his tail between his legs. So,
so you win that case, but yet you still lose your job.
Yeah, the bizarre thing there, Tim. After all the criminal charges were over with, they decided to, you know, they were embarrassed, you know, that they didn't get a conviction. So they brought me up on administrative charges that were identical to the criminal charges. But the only difference was the case was presented to a tribunal comprised of my own accusers. So it was like fighting City Hall. And so they found me guilty and fired me.
Wow. Which is bizarre. I mean, you have all these skills, you have all this training, you've basically been setting up these programs, yet why the backlash? Why what is it on that side that they've got this bone to pick with you?
Yeah, I wish I knew. I think a lot of it, Tim, had to do with a special prosecutor himself. He was just running with anything he could, and the state police were just giving in to anything he wanted. Hmm. And he wanted me for whatever reason. And but, you know, when I was acquitted the second time, that pretty much brought an end to his investigation. And then it ended shortly after that. So I think they felt pressure by the prosecutor that if they were to hire me back or let me have my job back, he would have kept it going.
Wow.
I think they did what they had to do in their opinion and let me go. I don't think they wanted to, but I think they felt compelled to do that and just, sacrifice me for the benefit of the good for the whole organization.
That's a shame, because I think anybody who reads this book will see how incredibly, not just incredibly skilled you are, but incredibly detailed you are at your job, and how you really don't let anything go. You don't let anything slip through the cracks, and you really, not only that, but you really do care about your job, and you really do care about the people that are involved in your sphere of influence.
I'm very detail oriented. I think that's what led to me getting assigned to the identification unit. I never really wanted to go there. I was happy working major crimes and narcotics. And as it turned out, I ended up working with these colleagues that were tampering with evidence. And because my name appeared on some of the documents that cases that they had tampered with, they just kind of grouped me right in with them.
Oh, that's a shame. That's a shame. So from there, you decide, everybody's got to eat. You've got to do what you've been trained to do. And by gosh, you've got, you know, decades of experience here. And so you turn to become a private investigator, which is probably the best way to continue. And I think, you know, it's for the best, because you're now serving people who definitely need you. And one of those people that definitely needed you was Veronica Taft. And and that's the basis for this book, Immunity for Murder, the Veronica Taft story. David, tell us a little bit about, first of all, let's set it up by telling people a little bit about who Veronica Taft is, and then we'll get into the scenario of that fateful day of what exactly happened. Who was Veronica Taft, or who is Veronica Taft? And let's set up for people what happened that fateful day.
Yeah, Veronica at the time that this happened. She's 23 years old, white female, and she had four young children, all under the age of five. You know, she grew up in a kind of a modest middle class home up in Whitney Point, New York, which is just north of Binghamton, New York. And for those who don't know where Binghamton is, it's kind of located in south central New York, about 200 miles upstate from New York City. And so Veronica attended Whitney Point schools in she was diagnosed like in the seventh grade as having ADD and ADHD, and she was classified as learning disabled. And while she was in school, she was often bullied and teased, not only by students, but even the staff. And finally, at some point, she was placed into an alternative learning center. And that was probably the best thing they did for her. Because once she got there, she really found her niche, and her ability to learn really excelled. In fact, she graduated with honors from the alternative learning center. But then after she graduated, she kind of moved out of home, and she found a boyfriend and moved in with him, and they ended up having two children together. That didn't end well. He became abusive to her. And so she kind of severed her relationship with him. Then she met another man and had two more children, including Lyric, who's the one the book is about. Just a brief correction. He was two and a half.
And I'm sorry, two and a half. Yeah.
But anyway, but that relationship became abusive as well. And she ended up severing her relationship with him. But not before Child Protective Services got involved and made her life miserable. But she finally was able to sever her relationship with both of them. And her kids got taken away for a little while, but she got them back. And she moved out of state for a while just to get away from everything. But then eventually came back in the summer of 2010. Mm-hmm. And shortly after that, she met a boyfriend named Chucky. He got introduced to her by a friend. He was a black male friend. He had come up from the Bronx, mm-hmm. and found a little apartment not far from her. And they started seeing each other. And so that's a little bit about Veronica. And there's obviously much more to the story.
Right. Now, with Chucky, Charles Pratt, he had an interesting background as well. Charles Pratt had, with previous girlfriends, and correct me if I'm wrong here, had been known to babysit those children, correct?
That's right.
Okay. So it wasn't his first go around with babysitting. So this wasn't the first time he had done that. And with that, we should also mention that Veronica, at the time, for her occupation, she was working nights at the Binghamton High School. She was working as a janitor overnight, so she had kind of odd hours. But that she was working hard to try and support the family.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she was like I said, she was single. She was on public assistance, but she was trying to supplement her income by working full time. She was always a worker. Mm-hmm. Everybody I talked to told me that she always wanted to work. And so she found this maintenance position at the high school, but it was a night shift, you know, from 11 p.m. till 7 a.m. You know, she found the job through a temporary employment service, and she'd been working in that capacity for about 6 or 8 weeks before this happened. And when she first started, she had a young girl, a friend of hers, who babysat the kids while she was at work. But then she met Chucky and introduced him to her kids, and they all seemed to kind of hit it off, especially Lyric. I mean, he followed Chucky around all the time. Mm-hmm. And for the next 6 weeks, everything went fine. While she was at work, and he babysat, and there were no issues. But then on December 30th, 2010, you know, tragedy struck.
Yeah, and we should also mention too, and you mentioned that everybody seemed to kind of hit it off. It seemed like Chucky was pretty attentive to the kids. I mean, he made them meals and he would tuck them in and everything was kind of fine. It didn't seem there. In fact, he never even laid a finger on these kids, did he?
No, he didn't lay a finger on the kids, nor Veronica. I mean, the police questioned her about that, if he'd ever been abusive to her or any of the kids, if he ever disciplined them, and there hadn't been any issues at all.
Okay. So on the date in question, kind of walk us through what exactly that day was like. Now, Veronica is kind of feeling fatigued, and she's really kind of gone through the ringer, and she wakes up a little late, doesn't she?
Yeah. So we got to back up a little bit to the night before.
Okay. Yep.
As she's getting ready for work. She was home alone with the kids, waiting for Chucky to arrive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the kids were in their room watching a movie. So she laid down, to rest a little bit for the long night ahead. And, she fell asleep kind of in a deep sleep and then kind of woke up in a panic thinking she was going to be late. But as it turned out, it wasn't as late as she thought. And Chucky wasn't there yet. Lyric walked in and needed a diaper change. So she did that. And he wandered back to the bedroom with his sisters to continue watching movies. And then Chucky shows up, right on time, about, you know, between 10:30 and, you know, yeah, around 10:30. And then, his brother, Jamel, whose alias was Mello, he showed up right behind Chucky. So he was there, when Veronica left to go to work. So around, just before 11 o'clock, her ride shows up. One of her coworkers at the high school, you know, picked her up, and then she left, goes to work. And so Chucky's there with the kids and his brother. So he fixed the kids a kind of a late night meal. That was kind of a standard thing that they did. Veronica liked keeping her kids on her schedule, so she kept them up late. So that they would still be sleeping in the morning so she could get some more rest. So that was pretty normal. So he fixed dinner for the kids, you know, macaroni and cheese and tater tots and I think French fries, and fed the kids, fed himself, fed his brother. And then he got a call from Veronica after she got to work, making sure he'd fed the kids, mm-hmm. and that they were okay. And he assured her that they were, they'd all been fed, they all ate, and now they were in their room watching their movies. So later that night, she called again around 1:30 or so. She thought that if she had time, she'd come home and pick up a movie that she could watch with her coworkers if there was time.
Okay.
But it turned out they didn't have time, and so she never came home.
Now,
so let me kind of fast forward to
explain real quick why they didn't have time. Now, it's kind of over the holiday break, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So,
yeah, ordinarily during a regular week, they probably would have had time. Mm-hmm. But this was the holiday week between Christmas and New Year's, and there was no school. But because of that, they had a lot more work to do. They had to strip and wax all the floors, which was above and beyond what they would normally do. So they were really quite busy that night, and it just didn't have the time.
Okay. All right. Continue. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So she wasn't able to go home and get the movie. They were too busy. So she works the rest of the night, and Chucky's there with the kids. Around 12:30 or so, his brother Jamel leaves. He came in from Ohio and to stay with Chucky. And so he was staying at his house. So he left and went back there to sleep. So now Chucky's alone there with the kids. And supposedly they are all in their beds and sleeping.
And now at this point, now Mello and Chucky had been playing video games. Chucky had changed into his pajamas at this point. Is that right?
Yeah, he told his brother that he was tired, and while they were playing their games, and said that, you know, he was going to be going to bed soon, and he'd already changed into his sleep clothes.
Okay. So at this point, Chucky seems like he's ready to turn in as well. Mello decides he's going to leave and go back to Chucky's place.
Yeah.
Now, is this the last time Veronica calls to the house?
Yeah, she called, I believe, Mello had already left.
Okay.
When she called around 1:30, she wasn't sure at the exact time. It was in the phone records. They confirmed that the call was made. She called from her work phone. She didn't have her own cell phone at the time. Mm-hmm. But Chucky did. So she would call from her work phone to check on the kids. And if anything else came up, he would have a way to get a hold of her. So Jamel goes home. So now Chucky's there with the kids, and supposedly, he went to bed shortly after Mello left.
Okay. I'll tell you what. At this point, David, let's take our break a little early, because some things happen overnight, and this is where it begins to get sketchy as to what exactly happened, and we get into the meat of the case. When we come back, something happens with 2.5-year-old Lyric that ends up in his death, and all hell breaks loose. And this is where we get into the meat of the case and who exactly did what and who's guilty for what. Now, keep in mind, we have the players in the case. We've got Chucky. We've got Veronica, who is supposedly at work and has been at work and supposedly doesn't get done until 7:00 in the morning. Correct?
Correct.
Okay. So we've got Veronica, who's at work, who's supposedly there till 7 a.m. You've got Chucky, who's supposedly in his bed. And you've got Jamel, who supposedly went home. So those are the three adults in the case. So when we come back, we'll talk with David M. Beers, author of this book, Immunity for Murder, The Veronica Taft Story. And we'll talk about why then exactly did Lyric Taft die. That'll come up next when we talk about this book, Immunity for Murder, The Veronica Taft Story, here on the Best in True Crime Podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome back to the Best in True Crime Podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. Our guest is David M. Beers, and we're talking about Immunity for Murder, the Veronica Taft story. We have a link for the book in the description of this program, and you can pick up that book. And by all means, please do. It is a riveting story. It's actually a redemption story as well. We'll tell you a little bit about that a little bit later in the program. But a confusing story as you read it. Because it's got twists and turns in here that you would never believe. And there's a little bit of a corruption story in here as well, David. And we'll get to that here in this second part of the program. And I'm finding that in your life, you're dealing with quite a bit of corruption. It seems like you seem to wade through corruption as you go through your life as well.
Yeah, indeed.
So when we left our audience at the break, we were talking about the fact that we have three players in this, and they all seem to be occupied in other areas. You have Veronica, who's at work. You've got Chucky, who supposedly has now gone to bed. And you've got Jamel, who's left. So at this point, David, we have adults that are sequestered in other areas. We have the kids who are safe in their beds. Now, we should mention the door to the children's room. The door is not like any other door, is it?
No. No, the door, it looks like a standard bedroom door, only it had broken off its hinges sometime in the past. And I mean, literally right off its hinges. So, I mean, the door didn't work like a conventional door. You had to kind of pick it up and put it into place. And it was heavy. It was a heavy, it was an older apartment, so it was a solid door. But if the door was up in front of the kid's bedroom, it was hard for them to come and go. That even though Veronica's oldest daughter was capable of moving it out of the way if they needed to get out. So that's the story about the door.
Okay. So we're now deep into the night, and it seems like all is quiet. At what point now, Veronica has into the early morning hours, Veronica's come home, but she's come home a little early, hasn't she?
Say that again?
After we've gone deep into the night come into the morning hours, Veronica has come home early, hasn't she?
No, she didn't come home early.
She didn't come home early? I thought she had.
No.
Didn't she?
No, she worked until 7 o'clock.
Okay.
And then her coworker that usually drives her home had another appointment, so she had to walk home.
Oh, she had to walk home. All right.
Yeah.
I thought
she gets home about 7:30 or 7:15.
Oh, I thought I had read that she had come home early because of that.
No.
Oh, okay. I'm mistaken then. Sorry, my bad. Okay. So she got home at about 7:15. She comes home at 7:15, there's something a little odd about what happens with that. Tell us what's odd about when she comes home at that time.
Well, it was a little odd because and she didn't realize it at the time, but when she got home and Chucky was right there at the door and greeted her, which was unusual. Usually he was still in his sleep clothes in bed when she got home, but this day he was up and dressed and met her at the door. And the other thing that was odd was that ordinarily when she would get home, she would go and check on the kids. But on this morning, Chucky's right there to greet her, and he assures her that, hey, the kids are fine. I know you're tired. You're on vacation now. You need your rest. You know, just come on in and get some rest. So, you know, there was no argument from her because she was tired.
Sure.
You know, she tired from working all night. And then just a few days before she'd had a miscarriage and she was still pretty weak from that. So she took him up on his offer that everything was fine. And she went in to lay down and he joined her. And they talked for a little bit and then she fell asleep. And then woke up probably around the 10:30 time frame. And, she heard the girls, awake, and she asked Chucky why he hadn't, gotten him up yet and fed him. That was usually his job.
Mm-hmm.
And, so she started to get up to, go check on the girls and he flew right over and, went in there himself. And he comes back almost right away and tells her that Lyric's not waking up. He's blue. He's cold. Of course, she starts freaking out. What do you mean he's cold? You know, he's not. What do you mean he's not breathing? No, bring him to me. You know, mm-hmm. So he reruns back to the room. And just so that everybody knows, that all the kids slept in one room.
Okay.
There was a bunk bed where there were a bigger bed on the bottom where two of them slept. One of them on the top bunk, and then the baby slept in a little pack and play in the same room. So anyway, so Chucky comes back with Lyric, gives him to his mom, and she's slapping him, trying to wake him up. And he's cold, he's purple. And she starts screaming, you know, call 911. And then so Chucky dialed 911, and then she just snatched the phone away from him and made the call herself in hysterics. The call was really, she was really in hysterics. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we need to do CPR. And then she flew down the stairs with the phone, still on the phone and yelling out in the street, you know, call the cops. Anybody know CPR? And a neighbor heard her and came right over and ran upstairs with her. And together they started doing CPR on Lyric. And in the meantime, the 911 dispatcher got a hold of an ambulance and they were on their way over. And they arrived within a matter of 2 or 3 minutes. They were pretty close by. And they ran upstairs and took over. But it was a very dire situation. And the lead EMT just grabbed them in his arms and down the stairs and into the ambulance. And Veronica was right behind him. And she got in with him and they were off to the ER.
Who was the first one to notice anything about Lyric? Anything unusual about Lyric?
Veronica hadn't noticed anything right away. The only thing she noticed was that he was blue or purple colored and not breathing. Mm-hmm. She really hadn't noticed anything else at the time. Chucky also claimed that he only saw some bruising when he went to pick him up, and that Lyric was wearing the blue jeans and a hoodie, which was also pretty odd. But nobody seemed to pay attention to that at the time. But it wasn't until the EMTs got there and they noticed that his abdomen was protruding, and which caused the little jean pants he was wearing to be real tight. So they took him off to ease the pressure. Mm-hmm. And so he was just in a diaper at that point in the hoodie when he went to the hospital.
Chucky had I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And then when he got to the hospital, of course, the emergency room doctors also noticed and described multiple bruises and injuries all over his body.
Chucky had a very unusual demeanor about him during this whole scenario. While the EMTs were there, while things were happening, talk to me a little bit, David, about Chucky's demeanor and then what he eventually ended up doing, which seemed unusual.
Yeah, he was acting strange. You know, Veronica really hadn't paid much attention to it at the time, but she did realize it later. But anyway, he seemed to go from one extreme to another. Like when the neighbor came over to do CPR, his wife came with him and was there to observe what was going on. And she just described Chucky standing there all calm. And even the neighbor who was doing the CPR, when he first got to the top of the stairs, Chucky was right there blocking the doorway and asking who he was. And the neighbor just kind of pushed him out of the way and went right to Lyric and started CPR. But then when the EMTs arrived, or as they were arriving, Chucky, who was just standing there, all of a sudden just, according to him, he became frustrated and he ended up punching the living room wall once with each fist. And he put a large gaping hole into the wall. I mean, it was like, several inches in diameter, right in the living room wall leading into Veronica's bedroom.
Weird. So at this point, they get little Lyric to the hospital.
Yeah.
They continue working on little Lyric, but to no avail. Lyric is gone.
Yeah. I mean, these guys were heroic in their efforts. They worked on him for almost an hour, but they arrived at 11:50 a.m. And they worked on him to for the better part of an hour, trying everything, warm compacts and warm saline solution into his stomach. But, when he first arrived, they took his body temperature and it had already plunged down to 86 degrees. So we're talking, 12 and a half degrees.
Yikes.
And then as they started to see early signs of rigor mortis and his temperature continued to drop. And there was never any signs of a pulse or respirations or anything. And they had a monitor on him, and that remained flatlined throughout. So finally, they were forced to make the call, and I think it was around 12:06 in that neighborhood that they pronounced him dead.
Mm. So Veronica went with Lyric to the hospital.
Yeah,
where was Chucky at this time?
He was back at the scene on the phone to his brother. Asking for an attorney.
That's a little unusual.
You think? Yeah, I'm just saying. I mean, he was on the phone asking his brother to find a number for an attorney he could call, and he hadn't even, the police hadn't even talked to him yet.
Not the actions of a guy who's innocent by any means. Now, I can only think of one reason. I mean, and keep in mind that most people don't think like this, but as a guy who had an African American stepdad, I could tell you that it doesn't look good in Binghamton, New York, that a black man spent the night overnight with a young child, and all of a sudden that young child is dead, and you're worried that, yeah, the odds are against you. I get that mentality.
I understand that. Sure.
I get that mentality. But at the same time, you also, I guess for lack of a better term, you have to let things play out. Don't you?
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, you would think you'd be anxious to, talk to the police and, answer their questions and, figure out what happened.
Yeah, exactly. You want to get down to the heart of the matter, and you want to come forward and come clean and get and see exactly how this happened.
Yeah.
At this point, how does Binghamton Police Department handle this?
Of course, they when they learned about the injuries from the EMTs and the ER doctors, they sent one of their officers over there to take pictures of Lyric at the hospital. And of course, they were able to observe the numerous injuries all over his little body, his face, his neck, his chest, his back. It even had gouge marks in his neck. Mm-hmm. The doctors seemed to think were from fingernail marks. And, just one look at this little boy, and he was beaten pretty badly. So, the doctors, did their thing. And then after he was pronounced dead, they did some more work on his body, with a CAT scan and that type of thing. And but so the police were looking at this as a suspected homicide right from the get go, because it appeared to them that it was no accident. He didn't just fall out of his bed or anything like that. So they were moving forward very aggressively with and they wanted to interview Chucky, and they wanted to interview Veronica and try to learn what happened.
Right. So they're doing the right thing. They're going about it aggressively. Sure. It sounds like the medical professionals on the scene are going about it the right way. They're going about it aggressively. We get to the point now where they've called Chucky in.
Yeah.
And Chucky has his interview. Is his demeanor right about where it should be? I mean, is he pretty forthcoming? Does he let them know exactly what's going on?
No, Tim, it was just the opposite. He was this guy was bouncing off the walls. in my opinion, he was probably high on drugs. And he was being anything but cooperative, yelling and screaming and, why do you hold me here? And, I want an attorney and nobody's talking to me. Everybody's talking to Veronica. Nobody's talking to me. What's going on here? Just, it was like he wanted to fight with him. One of the bizarre things that's almost unheard of, they put him in there and in the interrogation room and let him keep his phone. That's a violation of protocol. And then while he's in there on his phone, he's, calling his brother and he's calling Max and, making all kinds of comments on the phone, some of which I probably shouldn't repeat on the air.
Yeah.
this guy is, out in left field. And of course the police, even though they weren't in the room with him for much of that time, they were monitoring it. So they knew what his behavior was and how he's acting, what he's saying. But eventually they did go in and try to talk to him. It took a long time to get them to calm him down a little bit to talk. And eventually he did say things. But by that time, he'd already asked for an attorney. So they were kind of limited as to what they could ask him.
And before we get to Veronica and them bringing her in, she hadn't actually, even though he said, well, they're not talking to Veronica, they're just talking to me. They hadn't really even approached Veronica yet, had they, at this point?
No, he knew they were talking to Veronica because he knew that they'd taken her to the hospital.
But they hadn't, with her son. They hadn't interrogated her yet.
They hadn't interrogated her yet. They asked her some questions while she was waiting at the hospital to hear about Lyric.
Mm-hmm.
And then later they brought her back and put her in a room and continued questioning her there.
But wasn't it inferred by him that basically he thought she was in the room next to him?
Yeah, at some point. He wondered why she wasn't initially. And then finally they did bring her back and he was told that she was in the next room and he wanted to see her. But they said, he can't do that because she's still being questioned. And he didn't like that. He actually yelled out to her while he was there. Of course, there was no response. And then, there was nothing good about what he was doing in his interrogation room.
And like you mentioned, at one time he wanted to lawyer up, but then in the next split second, when he wanted to lawyer up and then they wouldn't say anything to him, he volunteered to spill everything.
He finally opened up and said, what he was doing that night when he got there and when Veronica left and fixing the kids their dinner. And, so he laid it all out on the table. Didn't make didn't say anything incriminating at all.
Right. Right. It was just his version of the story.
His version. Yeah.
Yeah. So we get to the point now where BPD decides that they want to talk to Veronica in a formal setting in an interrogation room.
Right.
So they sit Veronica down and they talk to Veronica, but it takes kind of a weird tone. Why is that?
They didn't treat her too bad during her first interview. But she was being very cooperative, trying to answer all of their questions as best she could,
mm-hmm.
Keeping in mind, she just found out a few minutes earlier that her son had been killed.
Right.
So that had to be pretty traumatic. She came in, she was cooperating, answered their questions. At one point she even, wanted to make it clear to them that she had nothing to do with it. And she offered to take a polygraph, but they never did that.
Mm-hmm.
Which really surprised me. I mean, usually they're the ones asking the witness or the suspect to take a polygraph. So they interviewed her for three, four hours.
Wow.
And then she leaves and then CPS was there because of the other kids.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to interview her. So she went through a lot in a short period of time, you know, within hours after her son died. So it was pretty brutal.
There was even allegations against Veronica that at times she was a former prostitute, at times that she had used drugs. She had volunteered to take a hair sample to prove that she hadn't used drugs.
Yeah, I mean, there was this group of so-called friends of hers that had, you know, filed complaints against her time and time again. You know, they had an axe to grind. They had fallen out with Veronica a long time ago, and they were just trying to make her life miserable. So they'd make these hotline calls to CPS. And of course, CPS did the responsible thing and they'd go and investigate. And they were accusing her of all kinds of stuff. You know, she was a prostitute. She was a streetwalker, and she did drugs. She hosted drug dealers. She cooked crack in her bathtub. She was abusing her kids all the time. They were filthy. Their bathwater was black. I mean, they just, everything you could think of. And of course, CPS would go unannounced and check on these allegations every time, never once finding anything wrong with her kids. No neglect, no abuse, no injuries, no bruises. And they even did on the spot drug tests of Veronica, and never once in all the times they were there did she ever test positive. So all of those complaints that they filed, none of them were all unfounded.
Yeah. So she goes for this second interview, and this is where things start to get weird. And that's, I guess, the best way I can put it. They start to get very odd. It becomes adversarial, where the first time was more sitting down and getting her information. And like you pointed out, she volunteered to take a lie detector test.
Yeah.
And it wasn't adversarial on her part. She's still cooperating. She's still saying, I'll do anything to prove to you. In her court, she's coming forward and she's saying, listen, I would never do anything like that to my child. What do I need to do? Now, there's something here I want to mention, and I'm going to backtrack a little bit. There's an autopsy that's done here by, I believe it's correct. A Dr. Terzian, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Dr. Terzian comes up with a formula, and you had mentioned it earlier, having to do with the body temperature of little Lyric. 86 degrees.
Yeah.
And it had to do with, I believe it's the formula is 2 degrees per hour. Is that what it is? 2 degrees per hour.
There's the standard formula that is used for an average sized adult is 1.5 degrees per hour. The rate of cooling after someone dies.
Okay.
But with a child, you know, he told the police that it could be 2 hours or even more, or 2 degrees or more, you know, for a small child, which is obviously much, you know, Lyric was only like 33 pounds, mm-hmm. where an average size adult's like 150 pounds. So, so the standard formula for the adult was 1.5 degrees per hour. And so based on that, you know, the doctor calculated and estimated the time of death between 3 and 4 a.m.
Right.
And as soon as they learned that, the first thing they did was they ran over to the Binghamton High School to try to corroborate Veronica's alibi, because she told them that she'd worked all night from 11 to 7. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, they were able to verify her alibi 4 different ways. So there was never any question that she had worked all night like she said.
So at this point, you would think that there really shouldn't be much argument from the Binghamton Police Department. There shouldn't be really any reason for them to turn their investigation her way. But that's the furthest thing from the truth in this scenario. It seems like at the end of the second interrogation, they very much became adversarial with her, didn't they?
Absolutely. I mean, the first part of her interview started out as a pretty normal recap of what she told them in her first interview. And then, they actually prepared a written statement for her, and she did that, signed it. So she assumed she was done. But then they came back in, and then that's when the like I wrote in the book, the tides had turned, and the line of questioning started to change, and then became, like you said, adversarial. They weren't accusing her of formally accusing her of anything, but the inference was there, and she knew that. And so the latter part of that second interview didn't go well, and but you know, she stood her own. And it finally came to a point where she had enough. She just stood up and said, "I'm leaving." And she walked out.
And I don't blame her. And note my facetious tone here, David. And of course, they called Chucky in for a second interview, didn't they?
Yeah. But he did. He refused to come in.
Of course he did. He wasn't going to go back in.
No. And he was trying to convince her not to go back in.
Now, tell me how that happened. How is it that we should set the scene as well. Veronica did tell the police that she was going to try to get a hold of Chucky because she wanted to hear it from him personally that he had killed Lyric, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's how she left it after her first interview. She told the investigator that she was going to try to, you know, connect with him and see what she could learn and report back to them. So when they went to look for her, to ask her to come in for her second interview, she wasn't home. As it turned out, she never went back to her apartment. She said it was too painful. So they ended up looking for her at Chucky's place, and that's where she was. So that's where she was. She'd gone over there to try to learn what she could from Chucky. And she happened to be there when they came looking for her. And she agreed to come back in for the second interview. But while they were there, they asked him and he wouldn't do it. But when they asked her, he was kind of whispering in her ear, you know, that trying to convince her not to go.
So from the outside looking in, it looks like maybe, I don't know, as a police officer, do you think the two are in cahoots at that point, if you're on the outside looking in?
I think that was part of their thought process, that she either knew what happened or was covering for Chucky who had done it. I think they believed that she knew something, and whether she'd done it or he did it, I think they believed that she knew something was covering for Chucky.
So at this point, they turn their attentions fully on Veronica.
Yeah, I mean, it turned to her rather quickly, like within the first 48 hours, and it never shifted. You know, it's interesting. During her interview, she was actually telling them kind of what to do. You know, she said to them more than once, "Hey, once you find out the time of death from the autopsy, you'll know it wasn't me."
Mm-hmm.
So, and she was right. And even though they knew what the time of death was, they never shared that with her.
And there were some strange things in this case that really the Binghamton Police Department, I mean, they completely either missed because of negligence or they missed on purpose. I mean, you could read this either or. I mean, everything from vegetable matter that was in Lyric's esophagus, which they sent out to be to another lab to be analyzed, and mysteriously it never came back.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit of both, that whether it was incompetence or just intentionally things weren't done. I mean, why wouldn't you want to know what the stomach contents were? That could have helped immensely.
Mm-hmm.
They never did that.
One of the things that's brought up as well in your book is you mentioned the scratches on Lyric's neck.
Yeah.
Why they never took samples from underneath Chucky's fingernails?
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of pretty bizarre, Tim. Because when Chucky was in the interrogation room that first day, you know, they noticed his knuckles were bleeding. And of course, his explanation was that he had punched the wall, which he did. But I don't think they give it any second thought that it might have happened as a result of his attack on Lyric. And the other thing that I'm sure you know about, I don't know if you want to get into it, was that there was actually specks of blood on Lyric's diaper.
I was just going to mention that. Yeah, please get into that.
So when Lyric went to the ER, of course, his pants had been removed. So all he was wearing in addition to this hoodie was a diaper. And so when he got to the hospital, the hospital removed all that clothing. But there was a patrol officer there, and then he secured it all, put them all in separate evidence bags and labeled them, just exactly the right thing to do. And then about a week later, one of the evidence technicians pulls the clothing out of evidence and starts to look at it. And on the diaper, not on the inside, but on the outside of his diaper, there's these specks of blood that she described as transfer stains. In other words, it was transferred from one object to the diaper. And in fact, one of the it was a disposable diaper, but you know they have these little closing tabs mm-hmm. that have adhesive on them that you have to hold on to when you're fastening it on. And right on one of the closing tabs was another blood stain that was crescent shaped and looked just like it came from like a thumbprint.
Okay.
And unfortunately, they didn't do anything with it.
Bizarre. And it wasn't looked at just once. It was looked at twice.
Yeah, but the district attorney looked at it later, and he makes a special appointment to come over and look at it. And then rather than have it tested to see whose DNA it was, and why is there blood on there? Where'd it come from? Because the Lyric didn't have any external injuries. They were all internal. So where's the blood come from?
And what's bizarre about the autopsy, and we'll just go over this briefly, is that Lyric had such blunt force injuries that this isn't something, and what's brought up in the book, and we're just kind of giving you cliff notes here, because of course we want you to go out and get this book. The book is Immunity for Murder, the Veronica Taft story. David yeah. M. Beers is our guest and the author of this book. There's at one point a search warrant put out, and there were quite a few search warrants, three to be exact, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So at one point, I think the second or the third search warrant was to look for plastic utensils, kitchen utensils, because they had claimed that Veronica used to beat the kids with a black plastic spoon. And
that's true.
To think that the blunt force trauma that poor little 2.5-year-old Lyric went through was caused by a black plastic spoon was just so ridiculous.
Yeah.
When you
know, I think they finally realized that didn't make any sense. I mean, yeah, their theory was that, you know, it started out by getting spanked with a spoon and then elevated from there into a beating. But yeah, the injuries were pretty severe. I mean, he had two injuries that were both of which would have been fatal. One was a head injury where his brain was starting to swell or had swollen. And the other one was a lacerated liver that it was like the doctor said in the trial, like split open like a ripe tomato and had actually detached from the spine. So he died from exsanguination, in internal bleeding.
Mm-hmm. At this point, BPD decides Veronica is our person we're going after. I don't know why. There's Of the three people that were there that night, the three adults that were there that night, other than Mello, Veronica would be the worst person to go after. Her yeah. alibi is solid, but they decide that yeah. that's the person we're going after. At one point, the public attorney was brought in, or she had asked for the public attorney to represent her, but they found that was a conflict of interest.
Yeah, it's called the public defender.
Public defender, right.
Yeah, she had sought them out after her second interview because she was in fear that, you know, knowing that they were coming after her, and so she wanted to consult with an attorney. So they interviewed her and talked to her, but they ended up having some type of conflict and being able to represent her. So eventually the case got assigned to a new attorney.
And that new attorney, who ended up being very good, got a hold of that case and started to pore over that case. And that's where you came in.
Yeah, right? That's when I got involved. I'd worked with David Butler, her attorney, on other cases. And so when he got this one, he looked through it and gave me a call. He said, I need your help. Because, you know, he saw all of the bizarre things that had happened, and he wanted me on board.
And we'll kind of leave that for our audience to read about how the two of you get together and you kind of pore over the evidence there. And you take this thing to court, and it's interesting how the two of you had built that. And of course, between you and David Butler, put together a masterful case. David, do you want to tell people how this thing ended up as far as the court case went and your feelings behind how that went?
Yeah, I can give them a little teaser there, but
sure.
Yeah, so this finally went to trial in August of 2012, and the attorney David Butler had asked me to assist him, so I sat right at the defense table with him and Veronica. And the testimony, I think it dragged on for about 2 weeks. And it was a rather quick verdict. And so we were really blown away when they found her guilty.
Wow.
Off she went to state prison. And her kids in foster care.
And her kids were kind of scattered to the four winds of foster care.
Yeah.
Now, we should mention throughout this whole thing that Veronica's mother, Hope, had the kids from the time that Lyric was murdered. But Hope didn't get the kids, did she? After Veronica was found guilty.
No, she had the kids for quite a while. And her initial plan was to keep the kids and raise them. But she had a personal issue that came up, and she wasn't able to keep the kids. So they had to find new homes for them.
That's unfortunate. I'll just put it this way. There is an appeal, but we'll leave the rest for the people to read about, because there's more to the story. There's just more to read about. There's much, much more to read about. This is a very interesting story having to do with Veronica Taft. And there's more twists and turns even than what we've talked about in this story. At one point, there's also a character by the name of Max. And I have my theory. I don't know that I should tell it on air as to why Chucky was never touched. You tell me, because we talked about it before the show, David. Should I...
I don't know. I always felt there was there was definitely a drug component to this case, but I don't know if it actually related to what happened with Lyric or not. But yeah, most certainly Chucky and a lot of his friends and associates and other players in this case all had drug convictions for various drug crimes. His brother, his friend Max, later there was another witness who was supposedly a friend of Veronica. He had a drug history. Mm-hmm. There was a number of them that had drug history. So I don't know what the...
And as David mentioned, there's a twist that we're not talking about having to do with a friend of Veronica's, and we'll leave that live for the book. That throws things in a completely different direction. And should we say... gives motive to Chucky? Is that a good way of putting it? To gave motive to Chucky to have done the crime? It's not a good motive.
No. It's not a good motive.
No.
But yeah, that's a really interesting part of the story as well, as this witness they found who was actually a friend of Veronica's. They'd had a brief relationship together, and they ended up going to him. Well, actually, he came to them because he got himself in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a interesting story to tell.
A very interesting story. So again, folks, there's twists and turns again, a fascinating book. I read it all in one shot. I couldn't put it down, David. I got to tell you that it was one of those, just as you think you know the story, you don't know the story. The players yeah, come in and you don't know at one point whether you think you believe one person or the other. The one thing you do know is that you know that Veronica didn't do it. You know,
yeah, and, most definitely. I was convinced right from the get-go that it was Chucky, and it just troubles me that for whatever reason they turned the tides on her and convicted her.
Yeah, it's very, very troubling indeed. Immunity for Murder: The Veronica Taft Story is the name of the book. It's available right now. And we have a link for it in the description of this program. By all means, click on that link. Go get that book today. It's a fascinating read. As I said, I read it from cover to cover in one shot. I didn't put it down. I just couldn't put it down. It was one of those books where not only very detail-oriented, but also a fascinating read. And I even had my own theory. Like I said, I told David as to why I believe Chucky scattered to the four winds and went free, and no one ever went after him. I truly do believe that there were deals cut elsewhere that let Chucky go.
Yeah, we may never know all the answers there, Tim.
That's true. That's very true. David, I want to thank you very much for joining us today on True Crime Tuesday. Very fascinating. I know you have another book out there. That other book is what? Tell our audience.
My first book I wrote, which actually became my inspiration to write this one, was Reign of Injustice, the Cal Harris story.
Okay.
That was kind of a 15-year ordeal involving four trials before he was finally exonerated. So an interesting story because I was involved in that one from start to finish.
Wow. All right. Do you have another book on the way?
No, I haven't started my next one yet. I have several stories that I'm thinking about writing. I just haven't decided which one yet.
Okay, that sounds interesting. All right, well, we'll look forward to your next book, and by all means, we wish you the best of luck with this one as well. Again, one more time, folks, Immunity for Murder, the Veronica Taft story. The link for the book is in the description of this program. All right, it's a time where if you're listening to the free version of the show, we must bid you adieu. But if you don't want to leave us right now, you don't necessarily have to. What you can do is you can go to Stitcher.com, click on the subscribe button under Stitcher Premium. That will get you to listen to Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals. That'll get you to listen to the ad-free version of Darkness Radio. And that'll get you to listen to hundreds of podcasts ad-free and expand your audio horizons more than you could possibly ever imagine. And the best thing is you can do it for just $5 a month. Do it right now. Go to Stitcher.com, click on that premium button, subscribe to Stitcher Premium for just $5 a month. You'll get Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals as far as True Crime Tuesday. You'll get an ad-free Darkness Radio. And of course, you'll get hundreds of podcasts ad-free and expand those audio horizons. Go ahead and do it today.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains August 8th through the 14th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.